about Leisner. Some Goldman bankers greeted him with, "Dr. Leisner, I presume," an ironic allusion to his questionable academic credentials. And there were his string of affairs, which struck some colleagues as unprofessional. He didn't so much engage in one-night stands as fall in love easily, floating from one serious relationship to another. He had begun a romantic liaison with the chief financial officer of Astro during negotiations for the IPO. The relationship, which was not hidden, led rival bankers to complain to Astro's chief executive that it gave Goldman an unfair advantage. After an internal complaint, Goldman launched an investigation. But Leisner denied any involvement with the woman, and Goldman dropped the matter. He was also prone to go off the reservation. As a junior banker, he would overstep his authority. He never operated within boundaries. He would offer clients and get permission later. It was tolerated because he brought in deals, said one Goldman banker who worked with him. In one deal that caused concern, Leisner gave a written assurance to the chief executive of Maybank, a large Malaysian commercial bank, that Goldman would underwrite a $1 billion rights issue, meaning it would pledge its own capital to buy up the shares and later sell them into the market. But he didn't inform his bosses in Hong Kong, despite the huge risks involved. Another time, Goldman cut Leisner's pay for passing information outside the company without authorization. It was a warning sign, but Leisner was making money for Goldman, and the bank took no further action. Leisner took little notice of the admonishments. This was Asia, the wild west of capitalism, after all. And seemingly, as long as the profits kept rolling in, Goldman bosses in the region allowed him a very long leash. In 2009, that led Leisner to an upstart Malaysian businessman named Joe Low. In early 2009, after the triumph of his Iskandar land deal, Low was looking for the next big thing. He'd built a quick reputation in Malaysia as a dealmaker, but as always, Low was keenly aware of how his success stacked up on a global stage. Low had observed the power and status of Khaldun al-Mubarak of Mubadala, who ran the Emirati Sovereign Wealth Fund. A fund like that had billions of dollars in investments, not mere millions. Why, Joe Low wondered, couldn't he put together a sovereign wealth fund of his own, one based in Malaysia? But where could he find the initial funds? Traditional sovereign wealth funds invest oil profits, and so Low honed in on the Malaysian state of Terengganu, which was rich in offshore oil and gas fields. Malaysia's 9 hereditary Malay royal families, each ruling a different state, coexisted with the nation's elected officials. These sultans had wide-ranging political powers, in some cases including control of local state revenues, creating ample opportunity for corruption. How Low settled upon Mizan Zain al-Abidin, the sultan of Terengganu, was typical of his ability to spot opportunities, moving from one deal to the next. The sultan, who had been educated in the United Kingdom, was from a conservative Islamic family. While some royals in Malaysia are entitled and lazy, he was considered to be smart. Low had met Mizan's sister, who sat on the board of the construction companies, and had used that connection to offer the sultan free shares in the Abu Dhabi Kuwait Malaysia Investment Company. This was the entity which had generated massive profits by flipping the construction firms. After this initial success, Low now suggested a more ambitious investment plan to Mizan. Why didn't the sultan set up a sovereign wealth fund, based on Abu Dhabi's Mubadala, which borrowed money against the state's oil wealth? Low said he knew bankers at Goldman who could advise and tap global investors, creating a huge war chest for the state to fund development. To buy legitimacy, Low also needed the involvement of Goldman. And Leisner, despite his initial concerns about the young Malaysian, was eager for the business. Low soon arranged for Leisner and another Goldman banker to meet Mizan and accompanied them to the palace in Kuala Lumpur. Within months of the meeting with the sultan, after which Goldman became an advisor, Low was sending bankers emails that referred to them informally as bro and discussing ways to portray the funds in Malaysia's media. Lowe's official role at the fund, which began operations in February 2009, was as advisor. But in reality, he controlled the show. And he hired a handful of people he knew as staff. Emails between Lowe and Leisner referred to the endeavor as Project Tiara. Lowe talked Mizan into allowing the fund to issue $1.4 billion in Islamic bonds, structured to avoid violating Islamic rules against charging interest, backed by the state's future oil receipts. But as the fund was preparing to raise the money in May 2009, the Sultan got cold feet. Lowe was rushing to get the deal through, but without a clear investment plan. Mizan saw no reason for such alacrity, especially as the fund didn't even have a full management team in place. His representative on the board ordered a delay in the fundraising, but Lowe took no notice and pushed for the bonds to go through. But now, Mizan, fearful of gambling away the state's oil wealth, threatened to shut down the whole thing. Mizan's reticence was further fueled by rumors in banking circles that Lowe had siphoned away some of the bond money, and the Sultan scotched Lowe's plans before they even got off the ground. Lowe was on the cusp of transforming into a powerful figure, the kind of young fund manager he had watched up close in the Middle East, deploying billions of dollars in investments. But now, he was seemingly back to square one, with Mizan ordering the fund be shuttered. He quickly had to figure out what to do. At that moment, he got the luckiest break of his career so far. For years, Najib Razak had been groomed for the nation's highest office. With his recognizable family name and years of government service, many Malaysians assumed one day he would become prime minister. The ruling UMNO party was in crisis. In the 2008 elections, its coalition had barely held on to power. Ethnic Indian and Chinese Malaysians, sick of living as second-class citizens, voted in droves for the opposition. To revive its flagging fortunes, the party turned to the heir of the Razak political dynasty. In April 2009, Najib became Malaysia's sixth prime minister, as if laying claim to a birthright. Suddenly, Lowe's cultivation of Najib and his wife was paying dividends. Overnight, the ambitious Malaysian had the ear of the most powerful man in the country, and Najib needed a pot of money to help restore his party's popularity. Lowe moved fast to cash in and save his stillborn investment fund. Chapter 7. Saudi Royalty. The First Heist. Aboard the Alfa Nero, French Riviera, August 2009. As he took in the opulence of the Alfa Nero, cruising off the coast of Monaco in the French Riviera, Prime Minister Najib Razak was under the impression the yacht belonged to a son of Saudi Arabia's king, Abdullah Abdulaziz Al Saud. With a movie theater and a huge swimming pool that transformed into a helipad, the 269-foot boat, estimated to be worth $190 million, was an impressive sight. In the stateroom, with comfy sofas and a view out to the Mediterranean, Najib was greeted by the purported owner, His Royal Highness Prince Turki bin Abdullah. Wearing a white baseball cap and matching blue linen pants and shirt, Prince Turki, a broadly built 37-year-old with a mustache and stubble, gave off a relaxed air. A former Saudi Air Force pilot who had begun to dabble in business, he jovially clasped Najib by the hand. Casually dressed in a short-sleeved white shirt, the Prime Minister laughed as he handed Prince Turki a gift in a green box. Najib's wife, Rosma, in a black-and-white leopard print shirt, who had joined the trip accompanied by their two children, smiled and joked with their host. Rosma looked thrilled to be in the presence of Saudi royalty, especially in such an intimate setting. Respecting Islamic tradition, the guests drank fresh juices. A photographer snapped pictures of the meeting. Najib and Prince Turki then sat, each perched on the end of a sofa, to discuss ways in which Malaysia and Saudi Arabia could foster deeper economic ties. On the periphery of the group, also dressed casually in a green polo shirt, stood Zhou Lo. Only he knew what this meeting was really about. In the few months since Najib became prime minister, he and Lo had spoken frequently. Lo had convinced Malaysia's new leader to focus on the Middle East. He'd already delivered Abu Dhabi financing for the Iskandar land project, and now Lo held out the prospect of access to Saudi's inordinate wealth. Aged only 27, the young Malaysian had managed to persuade Najib, and, just as important, Rosma, that he held the key to future Middle East investment. In the first few weeks of the new administration, Lo acted as an unofficial aide to Najib, helping the prime minister organize a visit to the Middle East. Najib had grand ambitions to turn Malaysia into a developed nation within a few years, and for that, he would need a major source of capital. Lo persuaded him it would come from Arab nations. Najib and Rosma, accompanied by Lo, toured the Middle East, meeting King Abdullah in Saudi Arabia and Crown Prince Sheikh Mohammed bin Zayed Al Nahyan of Abu Dhabi. To many onlookers, Lo seemed to be an official emissary for Najib. Such was his proximity to the prime minister. And some business people who met Lo on the trip mistook him for a minister of investment. In Abu Dhabi, after a dinner with the Crown Prince at the sumptuous Emirates Palace Hotel, Najib announced the formation of a new Malaysian sovereign wealth fund to be called One Malaysia Development Berhad, or 1MDB. The 1MDB fund was simply the Terengganu Investment Authority, which had recently raised $1.4 billion in Islamic bonds, transformed into a federal entity. The 1MDB fund would be responsible for repaying the bonds. Once Najib came to power, Lo convinced him to take over the fund, broaden its remit, and look for Middle East backing. From here on, the Sultan washed his hands of the whole affair. Lo had pulled on his connections with Ambassador Oteiba to help fast-track Najib's meeting with the Crown Prince, and to obtain a pledge from Abu Dhabi, however vague, to invest in Malaysian projects alongside the fund. The 1MDB fund was supposed to invest in green energy and tourism to create high-quality jobs for all Malaysians, whether of Malay, Indian, or Chinese heritage, hence the slogan, One Malaysia. The fund, Lo promised the prime minister, would suck in money from the Middle East and borrow more from global markets. But he had another selling point, one which Najib, who was ambitious, found extremely attractive. Why not also use the fund as a political financing vehicle? Profits from 1MDB would fill a war chest that Najib could use to pay off political supporters and voters, restoring UMNO's popularity, Lo promised. On the surface, such spending by 1MDB would be packaged as corporate social responsibility, to borrow a phrase from the corporate world. The fund's charitable arm would award scholarships and build affordable housing in areas where UMNO needed votes. On top of that, Lo told Najib that Middle Eastern nations, through their investments in the fund, would come to see Malaysia as a coveted ally in Asia, and also back Najib's administration with a flow of political donations. Was this young businessman, barely out of school and with a pretty short track record, really able to deliver Arab investment? He seemed well-connected. But would these powerful Middle Eastern kingdoms pour billions of dollars into the 1MDB fund just because Lo wanted it to be so? Why did they need him as a broker? Lo was doing his all to give the impression that he was indispensable, and the meeting with Prince Turki on the Alfa Nero in August was meant to deepen that feeling. Unbeknownst to Najib and Rosma, it was a setup. A facade of officialdom, aimed at making the prime minister and his wife feel they were getting close to Saudi Arabia's royal family. Luckily for Lo, Najib wasn't one to scratch the surface too deeply. After a lifetime of enjoying the perks afforded to a leading Malaysian politician, the VIP limousines, hotel suites, and yachts, he didn't ask many questions at all. In truth, Prince Turki was a new contact of Lo's rather than an official emissary of Saudi Arabia. Many people think of Saudi princes as having almost unlimited funds, But Prince Turki faced a precarious future. His father, King Abdullah, was around 90 and had 20 children, and it was uncertain Prince Turki would remain close to power once his father died. After his military career, he'd tried his hand at business, but had achieved little success. In the early 2000s, Prince Turki set up Petro Saudi International, an oil exploration firm, in an attempt to leverage his royal connections. The idea was that Petro Saudi, nominally based in Al-Khobar, a Saudi city, would win oil exploration rights in foreign countries that were keen to get close to Saudi Arabia. Like many minor aristocrats, Prince Turki was trading off his name, and Petro Saudi was little more than a shell, with negligible business to speak of. The company's success was constrained by the laid-back approach of Turki and his partner, Tarek Obaid, a 33-year-old Saudi financier. The son of a Saudi banker who moved his family to Geneva, Obaid had a round face, bushy eyebrows, and a stubbly beard. His father had made and lost a fortune, wheeling and dealing alongside prominent Saudi families, including the ruling Al-Sauds. Obaid attended international school in Geneva before Georgetown in Washington, and spoke fluent French and English, as well as Arabic. After studying, he had worked in finance, including for a small Swiss private bank, where he was considered lazy by some co-workers. As chief executive of Petro Saudi, whose operations were run out of a nondescript Geneva office building, Obaid played at being a Saudi royal, allowing his bankers in Geneva to refer to him as Sheikh, a designation for royals or religious clerics, though he was of common stock. The young Saudi liked to drink heavily and party in Geneva's nightclubs, and it had aged him prematurely. He was also a hypochondriac, perpetually complaining of phantom illnesses. Prince Turki was just the kind of figure Joe Lowe was seeking out, a bona fide Saudi royal to dazzle the newly installed Prime Minister Najib, but one whose need for cash made him malleable. Lowe recently had befriended the prince and Obaid through a 39-year-old Eritrean-American called Zale Ghebreyesus. In a former life, Ghebreyesus owned Lamu, a high-end African restaurant in Manhattan that attracted minor celebrities and bankers. The business had shuttered, and to build himself back up, he began doing favors for some of his former customers, arranging private jets, getting reservations at sought-after restaurants, and fulfilling other whims of the super-rich. Before long, he found a new calling, concierge for millionaire Middle Easterners who traveled to the West to enjoy the company of models, alcohol, and other vices not easily available at home. He would arrange boats and hotels and make reservations. This line of work brought Ghebreyesus into contact with Prince Turki. He also came to know Lowe, whose parties had grown in size since Wharton, fueled by the money he made on the Iskandar deal. Lowe wanted to shore up his budding relationship with Najib, and he relied on Ghebreyesus to see to the details. In August 2009, he asked Ghebreyesus to arrange a sumptuous vacation for Najib and Rosma and their children off the coast of France aboard the RM Elegant, a super yacht which came with 15 staterooms and an Art Deco-style dining room. At the same time, Prince Turki and his entourage chartered the Alfa Nero at more than $500,000 a week. Lowe's plan was to bring Najib and his family together with the prince, again making it appear like he could order up Saudi royalty on a whim. As planned, Najib and his family boarded the Alfa Nero and met Turki. On the boat, Prince Turki and Najib began discussing the possibility of Petro Saudi partnering with the new 1MDB fund. After the meeting, Lowe and Tarek Obaid seized on the interest Najib had shown, quickly hammering out a rough outline of how a partnership might work. Only a matter of days after the meeting on the Alfa Nero, Prince Turki wrote Najib on official Saudi government letterhead, proposing a potential business combination. With his missive, dated August 28th, he included a proposal from Chief Executive Obaid outlining a business venture. The plan, according to Obaid, was for Petro Saudi to put its oil assets, supposedly rights to develop fields in Turkmenistan and Argentina worth $2.5 billion, into a joint venture. One MDB, meanwhile, would contribute $1 billion in cash, tapping some of the money it had sitting in its bank account in Malaysia. Chapter 8. Hitting a Gold Mine. New York, September 2009. From the 35th floor lobby of the Mandarin Oriental on Columbus Circle, Patrick Mahoney took in panoramic views across the green canopy of Central Park. Located in one of the two towers of the Time Warner Center, the hotel's sleek lounge with floor-to-ceiling windows and a cream and marble-themed interior was the kind of place Mahoney was used to inhabiting. The Mandarin was a favorite of Joe Lo, who liked to be close to a good Asian meal, and he'd arranged to meet Mahoney in the lounge. The British banker worked for Ashmore, a British investment fund, but he also had taken on a role at Petro Saudi as director of investments. After his meeting with Prince Turki on the yacht, Prime Minister Najib had agreed to the outline of the deal presented by Obaid, Turki's business partner at Petro Saudi, and Mahoney and Lowe were at the Mandarin to get the ball rolling. Handsome, with hair swept back to just above his shirt collar, Mahoney had a reputation for being smart but cold, often taking a peremptory tone in business dealings, first as a banker at Goldman Sachs and later at Ashmore. Older bankers who came across Mahoney, dressed in tailor-cut suits and full of bluster, found the 32-year-old talented and ambitious, if a bit pretentious. He liked to email banker friends about expensive watches. When his niece cheated at cards, Mahoney joked that she shared his genes. A product of the rootless global elite, he communicated with Obaid in a mixture of English and French. In English, he spoke with a transatlantic accent common among deracinated Anglophones. Born in 1977, Mahoney met Tarek Obaid at the international school they attended in Geneva. In 2009, Obaid persuaded his ambitious friend to join Petro Saudi, and Mahoney jumped at the chance of a position of power in a smaller firm. Mahoney's role at Petro Saudi was to work on a plan to ramp up Petro Saudi's business. Quickly, he became the driving force behind the company, enticing Richard Haythornthwaite, a well-known former BP executive who was chairman of MasterCard International, to come on board to run the oil and gas business. In 2008, Petro Saudi had bought the rights to fields in Argentina and reached an agreement with a Canadian company to develop a potentially huge offshore field in Turkmenistan. Now, this Malaysian businessman called Joe Lo was promising to bring $1 billion in sovereign money into a deal. Mahoney knew little about Lo before their meeting at the Mandarin, occurring less than 2 weeks after Obaid had written to Najib suggesting the joint venture. But, with the prospect of a giant deal in the making, he made it a priority. In the hotel lounge, the pair sketched the contours of a plan. Petro Saudi would put in its oil assets, with the 1MDB fund contributing $1 billion in funds. On the surface, the idea was to use the money to explore for oil. But Lowe sensed there was an opportunity to make a financial killing. And he left the meeting in the Mandarin Oriental ecstatic. Soon after, he emailed his father, mother, brother, and sister, with whom he often shared details of his deal-making. "Just closed the deal with Petro Saudi. Looks like we have hit a gold mine," Lo wrote. With a billion-dollar deal in the works, it was time for 1MDB to staff up. Prime Minister Najib himself held the highest position as chairman of the Board of Advisors, with power to appoint board members and veto decisions. The fund appointed Sharul Halmi, a former consultant at Accenture in Malaysia, as chief executive. Other hires included Casey Tang, a finance director at a Malaysian retailer, who became an executive director, and Jasmine Liu, a smart Malaysian lawyer, as legal counsel. One name was missing from the list of positions, however. Joe Lo. Lo decided to take no official role. But in truth, he was behind every decision. Najib had given Lo a free hand to run the fund, and Lo had stuffed it with his associates. Tang and Liu were among the Malaysians Lo had gotten to know while doing deals after returning from Wharton. Plucked from relative obscurity, Sharol would soon show he could be relied on to blindly follow orders. With staff in place, things began to move quickly. Just days after the Mandarin Oriental meeting between Mahoney and Low, a larger group assembled in Geneva. Obeid, Low, Mahoney, and Seatley Lin, Low's Wharton School friend who worked for Winton, met for breakfast in Geneva near the lake at the center of the city. The small city for years had been accepting fugitives, at one time Protestants escaping persecution from the Catholic Inquisition, and more recently, financiers from the world over, looking to stash their wealth in property and private bank accounts. Before the Geneva meeting, Low had sent an email to his inner circle, ordering them to move fast to get the joint venture off the ground. After breakfast, Low took out his BlackBerry and connected Obeid with Sharol Halmi by email. Although the two heads of the organizations had never met, Low informed them both the joint venture was on track, making it clear who was boss, while insisting he remain in the background. "I trust all of you can now officially communicate and don't need to CC me for proper governance purposes," wrote Low, who also began to ask his inner circle to destroy emails after reading them. Without a formal position at 1MDB, Low didn't want compliance issues with banks or lawyers. Sharol replied to Low's email asking for more information about Petro Saudi, and Mahoney appeared to try and cover for the paucity of business. "PSI is very press shy and usually never announces our investments. One of the main reasons governments like to work with us," he wrote. He attached a presentation which he said should give you a sense of what we're about, but it included no detailed information about the size of the firm's assets. After the group left the breakfast in Geneva, the participants wasted no time in setting up the joint venture. Mahoney emailed Petro Saudi's bank, BSI, a small Swiss private bank, to start the process of arranging a business account for the new entity. Low went to meet BSI staff in Geneva, and Mahoney explained to the bankers how the new venture would soon be receiving $1 billion from a Malaysian fund, and Low would be taking a cut as a fee for helping put the deal together, just as he had attempted to do, but without success, during the Mubadala investment in Malaysia. Yet again, however, Low was thwarted. BSI balked at such a strange arrangement and turned down the account request. "I don't like the transaction at all, in particular the role and involvement of Mr. Low Tech Joe. Looks and feels very suspicious to me," one BSI banker wrote in an email to colleagues. Even at this early stage, any competent bank official could sense something was off. Bankers are supposed to catch wrongdoing and report it to authorities. But this self-policing system doesn't work. Turned down by one institution, financiers can simply shop around until they find someone willing to assist them. After facing problems with BSI, Mahoney turned to his private bank, J.P. Morgan, Suisse. J.P. Morgan agreed to open an account, seemingly asking few questions about why a sovereign wealth fund needed a relationship with a Swiss private bank. If the Swiss bankers had asked Low and Mahoney more about their intentions, and the pair had told the truth, what would they have said? Perhaps in the beginning, Low and the Petro Saudi principals meant only to take broker fees for setting up 1MDB with Petro Saudi, a questionable practice which nevertheless is common in emerging markets. Or maybe they planned to invest what they saw as government money, not anyone's personal piggy bank, making returns and putting the cash back. What's for sure is that Low was improvising, searching out ways to make money at each twist and turn, and the scope of his endeavors would soon broaden considerably. As Low's group forged ahead, they worked hard to ensure the pillars of capitalism. Lawyers, investment bankers, auditors, and valuation experts were involved at every turn. The effect was to give the deal between Petro Saudi and 1MDB a patina of respectability. For a fee, most were happy to oblige. Just over a week after the Geneva meeting, Mahoney reached out to Edward Morse, a former senior U.S. State Department official and energy analyst at Lehman Brothers, to conduct an independent valuation of PetroSaudi's assets, which 1MDB's board had requested before the fund sent its $1 billion investment. One of the world's foremost experts on global oil, Morse had worked with Obaid's elder brother, Nawaf Obaid, who had written a book-length study on Saudi energy markets. Mahoney told Morse he was seeking a valuation of $2.5 billion. "Okay, got it," Morse replied. Only 2 days later, Morse was done with his report, a technical analysis of reserves and prices based on numbers that PetroSaudi had provided. "I think you won't be displeased with our conclusions either on Turkmenistan or Argentina," Morse wrote Mahoney. His valuation range went up to $3.6 billion, more than Mahoney had requested, and a high number given the Turkmenistan fields were in waters of the Caspian Sea that were disputed with Azerbaijan. In the report, Morse made it clear his analysis was purely an economic valuation of the oil contained in the fields. He was paid $100,000 for the work. Others involved were happy to facilitate the deal, even when aspects of it made no sense at all. Timothy Buckland, a New Zealand national who worked for the London office of U.S. law firm White & Case, counsel for PetroSaudi, was eager to please his client. On September 22nd, Mahoney, in an email to Buckland, copying other White & Case lawyers, asked the law firm to prepare a document to send $2 million to an unnamed broker for helping put the joint venture deal together. Buckland simply replied, "Will do." It's unclear whether the broker fee was ever paid. White & Case also helped PetroSaudi prepare a presentation of the proposed deal. The slides, replete with professional-looking diagrams of money flows, showed how PetroSaudi would inject its assets, and 1MDB would put in $1 billion for a minority stake in the joint venture, based in the British Virgin Islands, all as agreed. But the presentation also indicated a strange payment of $700 million that the joint venture would make back to PetroSaudi. The payment, supposedly, was to repay a loan that PetroSaudi had extended to the joint venture. In fact, the loan could not have existed. The joint venture hadn't even been set up and didn't have a bank account. On September 26th, 1MDB's newly constituted board met in Kuala Lumpur to approve the initial $1 billion transfer from the fund to the Swiss account set up for the joint venture with PetroSaudi. Before the meeting, Low telephones Najib to apprise him of what was about to transpire. Then Low attended the meeting, one of the few times he was physically present at a 1MDB official gathering. At the meeting, Low explained the plan. He did not mention the $700 million payment. The board agreed to fund the joint venture. In the space of a month, since Prince Turki had written Najib with his proposal in late August, a multi-billion dollar joint venture agreement had been completed. Such a time frame, to complete due diligence, asset valuations, and other legal checks, was virtually without parallel. Such deals normally take months, if not a year, to wrap up. A 1MDB employee later compared the process to attempting to read the entire works of Shakespeare in an hour. Chapter 9. I Feel the Earth Move. Kuala Lumpur, September 2009. Shortly after lunch on September 30th, Jacqueline Ho, an employee with Deutsche Bank in Malaysia, was in a quandary. She was the relationship manager for a new client, 1MDB, and Casey Tang, the fund's executive director, was on the phone pressuring her to push ahead with a series of substantial payments out of the country. Earlier that day, Deutsche had received a letter from Tang, oddly delivered by hand, which asked for the bank to complete the transfers. But Deutsche's compliance department had some queries. Why wasn't $1 billion flowing to the joint venture with PetroSaudi, as agreed by the 1MDB board? And how come Tang was asking for $700 million to be put into an unnamed account with RBS Coutts in Zurich? Tang replied that the account, identified in the wire request only by a number, was owned by PetroSaudi and the transfer was to repay a loan. If they're going to overkill on the compliance thing, they have to be responsible, you know, Tang told Ho, according to a transcript. He seemed agitated, warning the banker that the joint venture might fail if Deutsche Bank didn't hurry up and transfer the funds. Yes, that's fine, but just one question as to why this is going to PetroSaudi itself. Is there any particular reason? Ho asked. For us, we don't care. Because $700 million, I mean, it's an advance that's owed to them, he replied. This is where they want to send. They want to send to Timbuktu also? We don't care. Yeah, that's fine. All right. We just wanted to understand the background. Ho's supervisor called Bank Negara Malaysia, the central bank, to check if it was okay to proceed with the enormous transaction. The bank gave the green light, as long as the money was going to the joint venture. Despite the confusion, Deutsche sent two wires around 3 p.m., one of $300 million to the joint venture's new account at J.P. Morgan Swiss, and another of $700 million to the mysterious account at Kutz in Zurich. As it was a dollar transaction, the money needed to pass through a U.S. bank. Under American anti-money laundering laws, these correspondent banks are obliged to check the source and use of funds. But with trillions of dollars flowing daily through the global foreign exchange markets, such checks are little more than perfunctory. And in this case, J.P. Morgan let the money through. 2 days later, an employee from Coutts Regulatory Risk Department in Zurich sent an urgent email to 1MDB. The employee was confused by Deutsche Bank's omission of the full name of the beneficiary of the $700 million transfer, which is required on bank transfer requests. When pushed, Sharol Halmi, the fund's chief executive, acknowledged the account was owned by a Seychelles company called Goodstar Limited. Goodstar is owned 100% by PetroSaudi International Limited, he wrote. Sharol was parroting what Lowe told him. In truth, Goodstar was another bearer share company, the kind made illegal in many jurisdictions, and its single share was held by Joe Lowe, who also was signatory to its accounts. Only months before, he had set up the shell company using the services of a trust company. It was a simulacrum of a bona fide business, a front the perpetrators hoped would shield them from detection. Still, Coutts bankers were not satisfied, and Lowe and Casey Tang flew to the bank's headquarters in Zurich to smooth things over. Here, they told a different story from the one Tang had spun to Deutsche Bank about the PetroSaudi loan. Goodstar was an investment management company, and 1MDB had decided to put in $700 million of its money. Why would a Malaysian state fund put so much cash into an unknown Seychelles fund management company? Whatever the Coutts bankers' concerns, however, the bank pushed the transfer through. The 1MDB money began to move across the world. Lowe had carried off a move so brazen, it was hard to fathom how no one had stopped him. Several years before, in Abu Dhabi, he'd learned how sovereign wealth funds like Mubadala were pots of gold, and he yearned to control one. Drawing on the Abu Dhabi model, Lowe had convinced Prime Minister Najib that Malaysia needed its own powerful fund to tap global markets, and that he, a 28-year-old, should be permitted to run its affairs. Lowe had tried to earn a commission for putting 1MDB and PetroSaudi together, but he'd been stymied by BSI. At some point, Lowe's scheme had evolved. Maybe PetroSaudi had been planning to invest the money in oil field development with the hopes of earning a fat share of profits using Malaysian government money. But Najib was giving Lowe so much room to maneuver, he dared to think on a grander scale. His people were running 1MDB, with cover from the Prime Minister. The involvement of Prince Turki, the co-owner of PetroSaudi, and a Malaysian state fund offered a sheen of officialdom. Indeed, PetroSaudi would later argue that it was an arm's-length transaction between sophisticated and well-represented sovereign parties. An idea had taken shape in Lowe's mind. Perhaps, he wondered, it was possible to take hundreds of millions of dollars in broad daylight. fooling Western banks and regulators. For Saudi royalty, the boundaries between state and personal wealth were blurred, and so it was becoming for Low. What if someone caught on? Did Low have a deeply thought-out plan about what to do when someone noticed the financial hole? The events of the past month had happened at a rapid pace, and he was ad-libbing. It was an opportunistic move, and Low had pulled it off. Like he had always done, Low would rely on his ability to think on the fly. In this age of social sharing, the conspirators could not even hide their glee. Seat Lee Lin, Low's Wharton friend, took to Facebook on the day Deutsche Bank sent the $700 million to Goodstar. "I feel the earth move," he wrote in a public message on his wall. From Goodstar's account at Coutts, Low distributed money among the group. In early October, he transferred $85 million to Tarek Obaid's J.P. Morgan account in Switzerland, under the pretense the amount was a private equity investment. Coutts permitted the transfers, and 3 months later, the bank similarly let through another payment of $68 million from Goodstar to Obaid. Weeks after, Obaid paid $33 million to Patrick Mahoney, and over 2009 and 2010 sent $77 million from his account to Prince Turki. Months later, Buckland, the Whiting case lawyer, left the firm to take a new position as in-house counsel at Petro Saudi UK. Low had pulled off his first major heist, and even after paying off his partners, enjoyed virtually sole control over hundreds of millions of dollars. Armed with inordinate wealth, he set off to see what was for sale in the United States. The answer was almost anything he wanted. Part 2. Overnight Billionaire. Chapter 10. An Evening with the Playmates. Las Vegas, October 2009. The Playmates were nervous as they made their way across the casino floor of the Palazzo. The young women, about 20 of them, a mix of blonde and dark-haired models, had worked in Las Vegas on multiple occasions. But the instructions for this job were especially secretive. Check into your room, put on a black cocktail dress, pack a bikini. The women had no idea who had hired them. It was October 22, 2009. Only 3 weeks since Low took $700 million from 1MDB. Hours earlier, the Playmates had flown in, first class, from across the United States. One of the newest hotels on the Strip, the Palazzo was an impressive sight, with stately stone staircases that brought visitors up to a lobby with an indoor waterfall. Beyond that was the casino floor, one of the largest in the country. Clouds that afternoon had dispersed, and it was a beautifully clear late fall evening. At around 8 p.m., the Playmates arrived at the door of a VIP room and entered. Inside, around a long card table, were a handful of Asian men playing poker, accompanied by Leonardo DiCaprio. Some of the models had met the actor before, but his presence in this gathering struck some of them as peculiar. The party, the women quickly learned, was an early celebration for the birthday of a portly Asian man who introduced himself as Joe Low. What, some of them wondered, was the actor doing in the company of these anonymous and rather dull men? After about 20 minutes of watching the group play, Low began to pass $1,000 chips down the table, one for each woman, and made a signal for the party to move to a suite in the hotel. With a huge security entourage, the group made its way across the gaming floor, as tourists looked on. No one appeared to recognize DiCaprio, who was wearing his trademark battered baseball cap, pulled down tightly to assure anonymity. At the doors of the chairman's suites on the fifth floor, the most opulent at the Palazzo, security guards waited. The burly men in dark suits and earpieces required the Playmates to hand over their bags, phones, and driver's licenses, and then sign a non-disclosure agreement before finally entering the suite. The women were used to attending openings and nightclub events, but this high-security atmosphere was strange. Nonetheless, the $3,000 fee they had been promised to hang out for just a few hours overcame any qualms they might have had. In the suite's living room, with a wood fire, plush couches, and doors that opened out to a pool terrace overlooking the strip, the atmosphere was somber. The lights were off, and hotel staff had constructed a makeshift dance floor of white tiles with a disco ball hanging overhead. The Palazzo had also set up a card table in the suite, and Lo, DiCaprio, and the few other Asian men went off to play baccarat, which they taught to some of the playmates who didn't know the game. With the ice broken, the gambling took off. Baccarat was Lo's favorite. It involves little skill, revolving around whether the player or the bank gets the highest hand in a complicated scoring system, but rewards or punishes those willing to wager big. Stephanie Larimore, a dark-haired model wearing a black dress with silver material around the bust, tried to make conversation with Lo. He was polite, but shy and almost unable to think of what to say. Boxes of German chocolates were stacked round the room, and Lo offered her one, saying the gold-wrapped squares were his favorite. "He's intimidated by women. Why have they hired us to be here?" Larimore thought. The men, smoking cigars, began to gamble large amounts of money, putting down chips of $5,000, and after an early winning streak against the house, some of the Asian men began to throw chips around the room. Some of the playmates, who were mingling on the sofas and around the table, chased after them, down on their hands and knees. After a couple of hours, a birthday cake came out, and the women crowded around Lo. Later, DiCaprio and Lo sat on a sofa in the dark, smoking cigars and talking, as they watched three or four women dancing in the living room under disco lighting. Lo then asked for some of the girls to change into bikinis and swim in a small pool on a balcony outside. "I think he was selecting people," said Stars Ramirez, a makeup artist who was present that evening, referring to Lo. "It was weird we were there. He didn't socialize with us." Around the pool were trays filled with barbecued food and ice cream, but no one ate much. Everything had been selected in advance by Lo, who quietly orchestrated the night's activities with a few words to staff standing by to cater to his every whim. Someone took off DiCaprio's baseball cap and wore it, but there wasn't really a party atmosphere. The actor was in the process of filming Inception, a science fiction film, and to some of the models, he still seemed to be in character, focused and distant. DiCaprio drank some bourbon, but there wasn't much alcohol flowing. "They weren't crazy party guys," Larimore said. Then Lo asked Larimore whether she'd like to spend a few days longer with him in Vegas. He would pay $10,000 and take her shopping on the strip. Some of the women stayed the night in the suite, but Larimore declined the offer and left to her own room around midnight. "It was like he was bribing you to stay." At that moment, in late 2009, Lo had access to more liquid cash than almost anyone on Earth, and he wasn't shy about spending it. Even before his big haul, Lo had made a splash in New York and Las Vegas, dropping exorbitant sums of cash, profits from the Iskandar deal. But in the fall of 2009, armed with almost endless amounts of money, Lo embarked on a period of incessant partying and networking. Even after the payments to Obeid and others, hundreds of millions of dollars were just sitting in the GoodStar account he controlled in Switzerland for Lo to deploy in any way he saw fit. There were no shareholders, no co-investors. His wasn't a Ponzi scheme like Bernie Madoff's, which used new money to pay profits to earlier investors. Madoff's fraud led to losses of at least $18 billion, but his take was a fraction of that, as the profits were shared among other investors. By the time the scheme imploded in late 2008, Madoff had amassed a paper fortune of $800 million, but most of this was the value of his market-making business. The amount he personally stole was a fraction of the amount lost. Lo's mark, the little-known 1MDB, a Malaysian government fund, wasn't asking for any money back, and it wouldn't so long as he controlled it through his proxies. Lowe also wasn't an insider trader like junk bond king Michael Milken and arbitrager Ivan Boesky, who had amassed personal fortunes in the 1980s through making bets on illegally traded corporate information, before they, like Madoff, ended up in prison. The Malaysian had simply taken hundreds of millions of dollars. The excesses of Madoff or the 1980s would seem prosaic compared to the multi-year spending spree on which Lowe was about to embark. His was a scheme for the 21st century, a truly global endeavor that produced nothing. A shift of cash from a poorly controlled state fund in the developing world, diverting it into the opaque corners of an under-policed financial system that's all but broken. Did he really think he could get away with it? Perhaps Lowe believed he could make investments that would more than cover for what he had taken. With the protection of a prime minister, who would stop him? To pull it off, Lowe relied on skills he'd honed for years. He knew that transactions between governments attracted less scrutiny from auditors and banks, and so he had set about building high-level connections in Malaysia, the UAE, and Saudi Arabia. He understood that once money was sent into an anonymous offshore account, it was difficult to trace. And he'd learned how to layer transactions, sending cash around in a whirl between shell companies. And to keep everything flowing, he constantly misrepresented money as investments or loans, giving his scheme a veneer of formality. But it was one thing to take money from a Malaysian fund and funnel it to Swiss bank accounts under the guise of a sovereign investment, using friends in official positions to address any concerns of compliance executives at banks. Now, Lowe wanted to get the money into the United States, so he could spend it on luxuries and begin building his empire. That was risky, because the United States had started clamping down on corrupt foreign officials buying assets in Western nations. To do so, Lowe turned to Shearman and Sterling. Founded in 1873, with its headquarters at 599 Lexington Avenue in Midtown Manhattan, Shearman was as white-shoe a law firm as they came, an organization more suited to handling major mergers and acquisitions than dealing with the likes of Lowe. Lowe claimed to have a relationship with a large Malaysian sovereign fund, and he appeared to also be close to Mubadala, the Abu Dhabi fund. So Shearman's partners apparently felt comforted about his reputation. The fact that Lowe held money with Coutts, banker to the Queen, was another level of assurance, as if the funds had accrued their own integrity simply by passing through storied institutions. Lowe informed his new legal team that he would be making a sequence of major investments, but he was very concerned about privacy. He opted to use the firm's Interest on Lawyer Trust Accounts, or IOLTAs, to help distribute the money. These trust accounts are typically formed by U.S. law firms to pool clients' money, say, when they are holding short-term funds for business deals or property purchases. This arcane corner of the financial world came into existence 3 decades ago as a way for law firms to earn short-term interest on client money to finance legal aid for the poor. But over time, the accounts developed a reputation for shielding the identity of clients in transactions and helping to hide the origin of funds. Some states mandate that law firms set them up. IOLTAs are at once good for society and a powerful tool for crime. Lawyers, unlike bankers, don't have to conduct due diligence on a client. Details of transfers through IOLTAs, meanwhile, are protected by lawyer-client privilege. While it is illegal for lawyers to abet money laundering, they are not required to report suspicious activity to regulators. The Financial Action Task Force, a Paris-based intergovernmental group that sets standards for stopping fraudulent use of the global finance system, has highlighted the United States' poor oversight of lawyers as a weak spot in its defenses against money launderers. In just a few years since graduating from Wharton, Lowe was becoming skilled in working out ways to use relatively unobserved parts of the financial system to avoid detection. Darkened corners where regulators don't have full visibility, and others had no reason or duty to be suspicious. These lawyer accounts fit the bill perfectly. especially because the wire transfers leaving an IOLTA account generally denote only the name of a law firm, not that of the client, making it hard for correspondent banks to detect suspicious activity. On October 21st, 2009, Lowe wired $148 million from the GoodStar account in Switzerland to an IOLTA account at Shearman in New York, part of a staggering total of $369 million that would enter such accounts at the law firm over the next 12 months. The reason Lowe gave for the transfers, noted on wire documents, ranged from property purchases to deals to buy companies. But at first, he simply used this money to fund endless rounds of partying. Between October 2009 and June 2010, a period of only 8 months, Lowe and his entourage spent $85 million on alcohol, gambling in Vegas, private jets, renting super yachts, and to pay playmates and Hollywood celebrities to hang out with them. Lowe set himself up at the Park Imperial on 230 West 56th Street in New York, a granite apartment building with geometric angles that resemble bookends and sweeping views of Central Park and the Hudson River. The move put Lowe in the company of bold-faced names of entertainment. James Bond actor Daniel Craig was staying in a $38,000 a month apartment there while starring in a Broadway play. And Sean Diddy Combs had a place in the building. Lowe rented a suite of rooms that cost $100,000 per month. The flashy new resident showed up at the building in a convoy of black Cadillac Escalades with a retinue of security. And he paid for a number of other apartments in the building for his entourage, which included Hamad Alwazan, his wealthy Kuwaiti friend from Wharton. Long-term residents complained about the bodyguards and the ostentation, but that was exactly Lowe's aim, to show he had arrived. He began to spend eye-popping amounts, running up a $160,000 bar bill at Avenue, a new club in New York's Chelsea district, on a single night during Fall Fashion Week in 2009. On another occasion, Lowe sent 23 bottles of Cristal to actress Lindsay Lohan's table when he spotted her during a night out in Manhattan. These enormous outlays landed Lowe in the New York Post, which called the big-spending Malaysian the mystery man of the city club scene. Lowe wasn't a total newcomer to the party world. Since at least the mid-2000s, his behavior had raised eyebrows. He would appear at clubs and outspend even the biggest Wall Street bon vivants, ordering $900 bottles of Cristal for no seeming purpose on a midweek night. Tracy Hanna, a cocktail waitress who served him in the Hamptons, remembers Lowe around 2005 spending some $30,000, a sum nearly equivalent to the median U.S. annual income, in only one evening. In this era of inequality, however, Lowe's behavior wasn't so notable. "We just thought he was some kind of royalty," Hannah recalled. "There were a lot of princes at the time, especially from Saudi. We thought they can't drink or party where they're from, so they go crazy in America." On another occasion, he flew waitresses from New York to Malaysia for a party. When Nawaf Obaid, the brother of Tariq Obaid, the Petro-Saudi co-founder, came across coverage of Lowe in the New York Post, he was livid. A security expert, Nawaf Obaid had spent decades at Washington think tanks and advising Saudi ambassadors to the United States. "Wow, this is very dangerous. He needs to be curtailed, 'cause at any moment he can lose his mind and blow the whole thing," he wrote in an email to his brother. Patrick Mahoney and Tariq Obaid would have surely been happy to remain anonymous and enjoy their riches. For Lowe, such behavior would have rendered the scheme pointless. He desired to exist and be seen at the center of a powerful world. The very point, it seemed, was for him to get close to the rich and famous, and to publicize it, just as he had wanted his name on the sorority posters back at Wharton. In the days after his heist, Lowe was driven by the need to live among celebrities, as if this would validate his worth. In the future, he would see Hollywood as an investment opportunity. But right now, flush from the success of his scheme, Lowe just wanted to enjoy the thrill of buying his way into celebrity friendships. To do so, he had to figure out a way to cozy up to truly A-list Hollywood names. The key would be a pair of nightclub entrepreneurs named Noah Tepperberg and Jason Strauss. The men were co-owners of Strategic Hospitality Group, a nightclub empire that included Avenue, as well as New York's popular Marquee Club, and a part share in Las Vegas-based Lavo and Tao. Tepperberg and Strauss were among the country's top nightlife entrepreneurs.